The House Committee on Business and Labor for March 25th, 2013. We're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3095. Listen, Representative McClain, we're going to close it and go on to another one. So I open the public hearing on House Bill 3095.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you allowing me to go quickly today. My name is Mike McClain. I represent House District 55. My district is a rural district of central and southern Oregon. I'm here to ask that for you to consider House Bill 3095 because of its implications for our state. I first became aware of some problems that were occurring in the franchise arena when my friend and former colleague at a law firm in Portland, Jerry Webb, who's here today, told me about some of the state interactions that his client, Jeff Freeman, who's also here today, had regarding his business, Janna King. Now, Janna King does not operate in my district. They operate typically in the metro area because they have a business that cleans large office buildings. The story, which I hope that Mr. Freeman will be able to tell, was one in which a lack of clarity in the law led to an audit by the Employment Department and others as to whether the franchise business that he was running was an employment arrangement or a franchise arrangement. And because there's a lack of clarity in the law, Mr. Freeman had to engage Mr. Webb and others to show that they were a legitimate franchise business. And where it came down to, they'll explain, but one of my concerns in being both a legislator and a lawyer is that when there is a lack of clarity, the agency has to have, or the agency by its discretion, intervenes in ongoing business relationships and has, and in this case, caused unintended consequences, or intended, depending on how cynical you want to look at the agency conduct, that is affecting the franchise business. And our state has all over it franchise business. And the relationships and the key to that is the nature of control. In other words, how much do you control your franchisee? And if you're the franchisor or your franchisee and then you have sub-franchisees, one of the key elements is you have to have some elements of control regarding the brand. For an example, McDonald's certainly has control over its brand and how things are done in a business. And yet no one would say that the franchisees or the owners of the respective McDonald's businesses, which I know you haven't, Madam Doherty, visited at least in the last hour, but the, but I bet Representative Barton has.
Yeah, actually.
But the, but if you look at it, those are franchisees' relationship, and yet no one would say, "Oh, McDonald's actually employs all these franchisees." So, the issue of lack of clarity on what control a franchisor needs to have over a franchisee has led to this second guessing of business models. And when you do that, it's expensive. It produces uncertainty into an economy that certainly needs certainty as opposed to uncertainty. And then third, it has implications statewide in the sense that those who are currently have or currently in business models that have franchise based relationships are, of course, wondering, am I next? For whom does the bell toll? Does the Employment Department or the Revenue Department or Unemployment Compensation or Workers' Comp, et cetera, do they come into my relationship here in Lakeview or Medford or Pendleton or Portland and say that, no, those are really employees? It becomes expensive and it's hurting what I believe a growing expansion of the economy. We need to be vigorous in that. Now, I understand the Employment Department and others may try to assure you that they don't exercise their discretion in any way that would interfere in the ongoing robust expansion of our economy. but I tell you, that's not the experience that people are having. I think what we have to do is clarify the law. Now, this bill, 3095, is certainly, I don't have any pride of authorship. There may be amendments that we need to do to make it even more clear. But one thing I wanted to do is bring this issue to the legislature and before your committee, Madam Chair, and at least make sure that we are having the discussion, and that to the extent we can clarify this, let's do it and not wait on that. I think there are a couple of amendments that I know some folks have mentioned to me that might make it a better bill. At this point, I have not submitted any to LC, as I am waiting to really determine whether this committee wants feels the same way that I do with regards to whether this is a legitimate concern. At that, I'll be happy to answer any questions, and I do appreciate your accommodation, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of Mr. McCrae?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. First of all, I just heard that you had to go first and have to leave for your National Guard duties. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
Second of all, you know, like you, this, I have some familiarity with this area law, and I agree. I'm somewhat astonished to hear that in a normal situation, an employee of a franchisee is deemed an employee of a franchisor. That seems bizarre to me. I'm sure we'll hear more about the specific details that brought this forward, but that seems very unusual to me, and maybe there's a fact-specific quirk that we'll learn about. But otherwise, I'm happy to work with you on this. It seems as you know, the area of law, employee, independent contractor, and franchisor, I actually thought it was pretty clear. Now, granted, it's standards, not rules and whatnot, so it can be complicated. But again, I'm happy to work with you. There's always potential for unintended consequences in this. But.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Barton. I welcome the assistance, and you're going to hear from Jerry Webb, who is a partner at Stoll Reeves and has been a friend and has an incredible three-point shot. Him and I played together years ago. You might want to ask him about that. But he has produced some materials for me and others, has done extensive research on it that I think highlights this unique area, which the lack of clarity on control is disrupting that relationship. And because because it's not that significant and it's rather boring to other people than you and I,
right.
It hasn't.
We get that a lot.
Yeah. It hasn't been highlighted, but thank you for your willingness.
Thank you. Any other questions? Quickly, please.
Just real quick for the record, Representative McLean, I want to get this right. You're saying Mr. Stoll, is that who's after you?
Mr. Webb.
Mr. Webb?
Who's here today, Jerry Webb.
Okay, so he carried the load for you in high school on basketball, and he's going to carry the load for you today.
He let me play on his team at his law firm one time and schooled me.
Representative Thatcher.
Maybe just a brief comment. It seems like I'm seeing a pattern of people who have, up until now or up until lately, have never been classified as employees and now suddenly being classified as employees. I think this deserves a broader look, too.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, that's correct. And you'll hear from someone today who went into their own business, sees themselves as a business person, and yet the state came in and said, no, you're an employee.
Yeah.
And that was repugnant to them and costly to everyone.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
McLean.
You.
Okay. I hope close the public hearing on House Bill 3095 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2672. And because we have four quite large, call Sarah Gelser, hearings today, and we've got 2 hours. I'm going to limit the entire bill to a half an hour. And so we're going to be watching. I mean, any of you that have been here know that I watch time like a hawk, so we want to make sure that everybody has a say, but in a nice, concise way.
And she's usually nice, so
yes.
It helps.
Usually.
But firm.
Yes. Thank you very much, Representative Gelser.
Have my Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, State Representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. I wanted to first thank you for opening a hearing today on House Bill 2672. This is an important bill that will allow us to extend basic employment protections to those individuals that are doing the work that makes all other work possible. These are the individuals that care for children, that care for homes, that make it possible for other people to go and do other work, who today are excluded, actually, from many basic employment laws. House Bill 2672 extends the most modest of labor protections to this group of workers, domestic workers. Last fall, the first comprehensive national study on this group of workers was completed. It was called Home Economics, the Invisible and Unregulated World of Domestic Work. It was based on interviews with 2,086 workers in 14 metropolitan areas, and it found very significant vulnerabilities for this group of individuals. First of all, who are these people? They are mostly women. In Oregon, we estimate there are about 9,500 domestic workers. Nationwide, we know that in that domestic workforce, 95% of the workers are women, 54% are people of color, again, mostly women, and 46% were foreign-born. They were born in a country other than the United States and then immigrated to the United States and did this work. Many individuals come through organizations that match people to come and do domestic work within homes. Now, there are many people who are good employers to the individuals that provide domestic work for them, and this bill is not intended to suggest otherwise. But one of the recurring themes in this report was that domestic workers are much more isolated than other workers because they are doing their work in private homes behind closed doors. And I just wanted to quote from the report, "Working behind closed doors, beyond the reach of personnel policies, and often without employment contracts, they are subject to the whims of their employers. Some employers are terrific, generous, and understanding. Others, unfortunately, are demanding, exploitative, and abusive." House Bill 2672 is intended to provide some very basic protections to these workers. The first is to be informed in writing of their rate of pay, so when they go to work for an individual, they know what to expect to be paid, and that they would have written information about what their job expectations are, what is the work that they are supposed to do. It would also ensure that they had information about any leave that they might be entitled to. Currently, these workers are excluded from most wage and hour laws, so this would ensure that workers who work over 40 hours a week would be eligible for overtime pay if they lived out of the home, or over 44 hours a week if they lived in the home. It would be one of the other important protections in here is that these employees would have access to cook food for themselves that was appropriate for their health or their culture. It would extend 3 paid personal leave days after a year of employment, and would also extend sexual harassment protections to these employees. Right now, they have no protection from harassment based on gender, based on sex, based on sexual orientation, or disability. BOLI would adopt most of the rules related to this. We've done a lot of work in the legislature around the issue of sex trafficking. There is actually an even bigger problem of labor trafficking, where individuals are kind of moved from place to place, not paid fair wages, and they are unable to leave because their employers may hold on to their passports. House Bill 2672 prohibits employers from requesting or requiring that they keep possession of an individual's passport. It's important to note that the bill is very limited. It does not apply to a parent or spouse. It doesn't apply to children under the age of 21 or students or teenagers providing babysitting services. This doesn't kind of impact people's babysitters. And it doesn't impact people who perform casual labor. We have amendments, the -3 amendments, which also changed the bill to clarify that the bill does not apply in the economic protections to individuals that are covered by a collective bargaining agreement or companion caregivers. As you know, there's a lot of debate right now at the federal level around work exemptions for people that work as companions. So we're really looking primarily at nannies and housekeepers. Again, just to quickly go over what is covered, prior to the start of employment and on the anniversary of employment, and when there's a pay rate change, the employer gets it in writing. There's that eligibility for overtime for over 40 or 44 hours a week. It ensures that there's at least one day off that the individual gets a week. So after you've worked for 6 days, you get a day of rest, 24 hours of rest. If that's not possible, you would be eligible for overtime for that. If the worker lives in the home, access to 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep in a 24-hour period, permitting the worker to cook their own food, and having time to eat. Again, one of the important clarifications to make about this bill that's different than legislation in other states is it does not require that this be a duty-free meal period. It simply requires that the individual have the opportunity to eat. And then finally, the non-economic protections. The employer may not take possession of the worker's passport. The employer may not make submission to unwanted sexual advances a condition for employment or a basis for employment decisions, may not harass a worker sexually or based on gender, race, religion, or national origin, and may not retaliate against an employee because they have inquired about worker protections. It's my understanding that this bill should have a minimal or no fiscal. It really is a very modest response to the needs of these workers, and I'm happy to answer any questions and hope that you will carefully consider this bill and hopefully move it forward for a work session so that we can provide basic protections to these workers, start to bring them out of the shadow, and extend the basic employment protections to them that they deserve, both respecting them as individuals and respecting the extraordinarily important work that they do.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of Representative Gelser? I just have one. How, since a lot of these are in the home, employment, and so on, how is the employer going to know that these rules have been implemented, since a lot of these people just hire domestics?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, hopefully individuals that are employing domestics are already having some sort of a relationship with the state in terms of tax withholding and other types of activities. I know that when we needed a babysitter that came on a more regular basis, it wasn't a casual babysitter we had reporting that we needed to do to the state, and we were informed of our obligations as an employer.
Is there an education component for the workers, so they'll know this also?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is not addressed in this bill.
Okay, no, fine. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you, Representative Gelser. Okay. Next we have Elizabeth Kushwa, Lily Hoag, and Alana Guinea.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa. I'm the Legislative Director with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Fully is supportive of House Bill 2672, especially with the Dash 3 amendments, excuse me, which has removed the provision for companion workers. We're expecting a federal definition or a federal rule change here in the next 2 months, and so appreciate that Representative Gelser has taken that into account. Excuse me. The bill does not change current law in terms of overtime for domestic workers not residing in the home. Such workers are already entitled to overtime, over 40 hours a week. The record-keeping piece of the bill is also consistent with current law, and we appreciate that. We will continue to work with the representative to make any further tweaks necessary to make the bill acceptable to the body.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Question now? Or?
Please, if I could, just
okay.
Do you have much in the way of complaints regarding this kind of employment?
Representative Doherty, Representative Kenemer, we haven't had very many complaints on this, and that happens to do more with the fact that many of these workers are not native English speakers. They're not aware of BOLI's protections and workplace protections.
Chair Doherty, committee members. My name is Lily Hoag. I'm the Policy Director for Family Forward Oregon. I want to be the person who shares a little bit about the history of domestic workers in the U.S. To give some context about employment law for domestic workers. Originally, the first domestic workers definition was actually based around slavery in the U.S. And in 1865, though slavery was abolished, domestic workers were specifically left out of labor protections because over a long period of compromises, employers in the South wanted to keep a larger group of cheap domestic labor. In 1938, the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed, which created the basic labor standards, which most workers in Oregon enjoy today. But due to the desire to keep this cheap labor, also domestic workers were explicitly left out of these laws. So at Family Forward, we think House Bill 2672 will help to right this historical wrong by giving domestic workers basic rights like overtime, access to time to eat, the ability to sleep more than 5 hours a night sometimes. And to paint a clear picture, of the almost 10,000 domestic workers in Oregon, the majority are hired without the safety net of a work contract. They mostly rely on verbal contracts. Often employers, who can be really wonderful, think of these people as de facto family members, which is great. But also what it means is that they may not understand the need to provide a healthy and safe work environment for people who are providing care in their home. We believe that legislation is needed to allow people appropriate rest breaks and to provide safety and protection against intimidation or sexual harassment, something which currently domestic workers have no protections from. We believe being employed as a domestic care worker should never mean a person is not paid for the time they work, that they are allowed to get protection from, that they aren't unduly disadvantaged simply because they provide care. And in a recent study nationally, 67% of domestic workers were given no overtime pay for the extra work they provided. So we're really excited about this, and we hope that you'll move 2672 forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill today. My name is Ilana Guinea. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon AFL-CIO. I generally work with Oregonians who have the ability to advocate for themselves. That's one of the main reasons we hear from our members for why they formed a union in the first place. Domestic workers don't have that ability. As the representative said when she was introducing the bill, these workers are currently excluded from many employment laws. They often work alone. They're separated from other workers who could help them advocate for the things that they need in the workplace. And as Lily mentioned, often their employers don't see them as workers as much as they do a part of the family, which can be beneficial but can also leave people without the protections they need. There can be cultural differences, power differences, and a lot of things adding up to create an environment where people who work in domestic professions don't always feel that they have the ability to ask for the things they need or tell their employer that things aren't working as they should be. We believe this bill will help begin to address that problem. I understand that there are amendments, which I have not had an opportunity yet to show to our members who might be affected by them. I am assuming that everything will be fine with them, but I do need to look at those before I can categorically say that we will continue to support this. But as the bill currently stands and as the amendments have been described to me, we would encourage your support for this bill to help give these workers the opportunity to advocate for what they need on the job and create a more balanced, healthy relationship between these employers and the workers who help their families. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of the panelists? Representative Kinnemer.
I didn't catch it earlier when the sponsor was here. I haven't gotten the bill up yet, but is there any requirement regarding language barriers in the bill?
No.
Okay, that's what I thought. Thank you.
Chair Doherty, Representative Kinnemer, no.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
I'm curious, this one section, someone who employs a domestic worker may not engage in unwelcome sexual advances, request sexual favors, or engage in other verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature, etc. In another part of the bill, it excludes casual workers under the age of 21. Do they have protection somewhere else, or why would we? Seems like that's a vulnerable population.
Chair Doherty, Representative Thompson, absolutely. This bill doesn't cover those people because it doesn't cover casual laborers. I'm unaware of legislation that does cover, and I can look into that for you. But I do know that this is about domestic workers who work consistently in one home.
I don't approve anything in law that says it's okay to take advantage of people under the age of 21 if they're casual workers, then we abuse the heck out of them, you know. That's not a good idea.
Thank you. I'm sure we do not condone that.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions of the panelists? Thank you very much. Okay. Next, Mr. Wilson, J.L. Wilson.
Well, I'm sorry.
Yes. Mr. Lopez, we'll have you and Christina next.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Unless all three of you want to come up. Come on up. Give them some. Okay. Christina Castro and Francisco Lopez, please.
Thank you. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industry. Just a couple comments. First of all, we would appreciate a definition of employer in the bill. It was hard to render a judgment either way on the issue given the fact that employer was not defined in the legislation. And the legislation often refers to a person employing, and we don't know what that means. If in fact it's an agency, then these workers currently have protections. I presume it doesn't mean an agency, but that should be specified in the legislation. Also, something that is not contained would be an independent contractor exemption. For example, there are many people who clean homes or perhaps do handiwork. It is their business, and the fact that they're not there's not an exemption in this bill for these types of folks might cause confusion when you get into the paid days off requirement, the rest and meal break requirement, overtime, that kind of thing. If there is not a contemplation of the everyday occurrence of people who just simply have their own house cleaning companies or their own mm-hmm. handiwork companies, those types of things. The third point I'll make just as it relates to personal experience, and that is as a primary caretaker for my grandfather, my mom and I, when he was passing away and he started to develop dementia and things got pretty hairy in the last days and months of his life, and I don't think there is, but you know, maybe this is a bully function, but you know, I hope there is not an intent to cause, you know, a right of action against me or my mom or my grandfather's estate for the things that happen in those types of situations, because you know, things are said and you know, due to dementia in his instance, that might warrant some consideration in this or in the rulemaking process. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for your input.
Thank you. The Chair, Doherty, and committee members, my name is Francisco Lopez, and I'm the Executive Director of CAUSA. We are the largest civil and human rights organization in the Pacific Northwest, with offices in Portland, Bend, and Salem. We work very close with allies and other Latino organizations in 20 counties around the state of Oregon. You know, with working parents playing a vital role in Oregon's economy, it is important to acknowledge the domestic workers who assist working families by providing child and home care. In a typical morning in the suburbs of Portland, Lake Oswego, Corvallis, Kaiser and Eugene, South Salem, and Bend, these domestic workers push strollers to parks, prepare healthy meals, walk dogs, and clean homes. Who are these women pushing those strollers? Who are the women helping to make sure that these babies are safe? Who are these women feeding dogs, cats, cleaning the house, cooking a meal? Who are these women going to elementary school to pick up little John or Mary? I know who they are. Their names are Maria, Cristina, and Antonia. There are more than the 3,722 Latina domestic workers in Oregon supporting working families and caring for their children. House Bill 2672 is simple in nature and is designed to establish a basic floor of labor rights for domestic workers, for these women that we call family, ranging from the ability to cook and eat their own food to getting 24 consecutive hours of rest of each week. The blurred lines between family, home, and workplace combined with lack of legal protections means domestic workers can face particularly harsh working conditions, often worse for these who live in. Many of these workers are on call for their employer 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. What we are asking is, you know, to get some basic rights to these women, you know, that work long hours, often without breaks or for very low pay. They have enough hours to sleep, to have time off, that they can visit their families. You know, House Bill 2672 will provide domestic workers in Oregon basic rights. We should pass this bill that will benefit these women that we call family. Just want to say that in more than one occasion, I have seen some of these children now, you know, and many of them, they're even there is another benefit of this. Some of them are speaking Spanish now because these domestic workers have taught them the language. This is a very powerful contribution that these women do. Thank you very much. And Madam Chair, I want to say I want to translate for Castro because
thank you very much.
Buenos días, señoras y señores diputados. Mi nombre es María Cristina Castro. Tengo más de 60 años y soy empleada doméstica en el área de Ceylan por más de 9 años.
Good morning, members of the state legislature. My name is Cristina Castro. I'm 60 years old. I've been a domestic worker in the Ceylan area for the last 9 years.
He ayudado a varias familias en el cuidado de sus seres queridos, ya sea viviendo en la casa o concurriendo diariamente.
I've been helping a lot of families with their loved ones, you know, either living at home or going to these homes every day.
Mis tareas han sido diversas, como el cuidado directo de ancianos, asistiendo en sus necesidades diarias, cuidado de personal y de la casa, cocinando, lavando la ropa, acompañándolos al doctor.
I've been assisting these families in different chores, from taking care of elderly, assisting their daily needs, personal care at home, cooking, cleaning clothes, doing laundry, and also taking them more than one time to the doctor.
La otra parte importante en mi carrera laboral ha sido la atención y cuidado de niños.
The other part of my work has been the taking care of children.
Uno en especial estuvo 5 años cada día recibiendo mi cariño, educación y nutrición.
There is one in special that I took care for 5 years. Every day he received my love. I helped him with his education and nutrition.
Yo lo transportaba a la escuela y a las distintas actividades. Este niño me quiere como si fuera su abuela y todavía lo visito, aunque ya no trabajo con ellos.
You know, the parents used to leave him with my care. I would drive to the school and I did a lot of things. You know, this child, I no longer work with him, but this child considered me like his grandma. And I regularly visit him, even though that I no longer work with them.
Este cuadro amplio no estaría completo si no mencionara otras tareas que he realizado con otros patrones, como es el cuidado de mascotas, perros y gatos, y la limpieza de casas.
This picture would not be complete if I don't mention my other chores, such as taking care of cats, dogs, cleaning homes, and many places around Salem.
Si tengo que calificar las experiencias hasta el momento, puedo decir que han sido buenas y malas.
If I can give a qualify or explain how my experience, I have had good experience, but also I have bad experiences.
En algunos casos se me ordenó no hablar mi primer idioma en presencia del dueño de casa.
In more than one occasion was ordered not to speak my first language in the presence of the owner of the house.
En otros se palpaba la desconfianza o el recelo.
And many times they didn't trust me, and then sometimes some people were angry with me.
Yeah, and el control.
A lot of control over me.
Uh-huh. En una ocasión tuve que limpiar el piso de rodillas porque no tenían el trapeador.
More than one occasion I have to get on my knees and work, clean the floor in my knees because that family, they wanted to give me a mat to clean the floor.
Aunque no es mi caso, tengo el testimonio de amigas, compañeras, mujeres que han sufrido abuso verbal y no han tenido receso o aún no han cobrado su dinero.
I have compañeras, colleagues of mine, other domestic workers that also haven't been receiving their payment. You know, they have been verbally abused and they're still waiting for their salary.
Trabajando a la noche me pagaban $5 por hora.
When I work at night, they used to pay me $5 an hour.
Pero no tenía otro ingreso, tenía que tomarlo.
I didn't have any other income, so I had to take that job.
En otra situación, mi comida estaba incluida en el salario, pero no, mi colesterol es alto y no tenía más remedio que gastar mi dinero si quería comer saludable.
You know, I have high cholesterol, and sometimes I had to eat what they were providing me, because of my cholesterol, sometimes I had to use my own money to buy my own food. I wanted to eat healthy.
Sería injusta si no reconociera a las familias que muestran respeto, amistad, que pagan a tiempo y nos consideran una gran ayuda para sus vidas muy ocupadas.
It would be unjust if I didn't recognize the good families that have shown me respect, friendship, and they pay the salary on time.
Quisiera que las experiencias buenas que he tenido sean la norma de todos los empleadores.
I wish that the good experience that I had should be the rule of law for our employers.
Nosotros somos más que empleadas domésticas. Somos mujeres que trabajamos para dar lo mejor que tenemos y cuidar niños como si fueran nuestros propios hijos.
We are more than just domestic workers. We give the best what we have and we take care of our children like they were our own children.
Nosotras somos las que hacemos posible que muchas mamás y papás puedan tener una vida de profesionales y están confiados en nosotros que cuidamos a sus hijos, a sus animales, a sus casas.
What we do is we make possible to many working parents that they can have professional lives where we are taking care of their children, their animals, their pets, and cooking at home and cleaning home.
Okay, if we could summarize and wrap up. Thank you.
Pero hoy la empleada doméstica es considerada en un nivel más bajo y no recibe beneficios de salud y no tienen algunos derechos. Por favor, ayúdenos para que podamos ser tratadas con dignidad y con justicia. Muchas gracias.
And you know, right now domestic workers are considered at the lower level, that we don't receive any benefits and we don't have any rights. Please help us to have some basic rights and we can be treated with dignity and respect and justice. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of the panelists? Okay, thank you much for your time coming and speaking with us today. Okay, that concludes the people signed up for House Bill 2672. So I close the public hearing on House Bill 2672 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3095.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman, representing Jana King. I am not the body double for Representative Mike McLean, if any of you are wondering, even though we're dressed like today. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. House Bill 3095 is very straightforward. It seeks to clarify Oregon law by saying that independent businesses that are franchisees are not employees. Very simple. This legislation, as Representative McLean had said earlier, is born out of a situation whereby the Employment Department of the state sought to reclassify an independent business as an employee and not a franchisee, even though it had a legitimate franchise agreement. My client thought the law was clear. Courts have supported our position, but the Oregon Employment Department has recently changed its tune, even though franchise relationships have been in the law for about 50 years. And my client, who has been operating as a franchisee in Oregon for 20 years, just recently was notified by the Employment Department of its change of tune. On the Oregon Department Employment Department website, it highlights the agency's missions and values. And one of the three values it says it has is it consistently applies laws and policies to ensure customers receive fair and equal treatment. Customers, in this case, are businesses. I think you'll learn today that that is not true, and that the agency has even told my client that you lawmakers in Oregon should give clearer direction to the agency as it relates to franchise law. You will also learn that franchise relationships are important to the economy of both the United States and Oregon. In 2007, which is the latest data we have, here in Oregon, there are more than 10,400 franchisees, which employ around 115,000 people in the state. Uncertainty with franchise law is bad for business, particularly small businesses that tend to be these franchisees. You heard from Representative McLean sort of the best example of the McDonald's situation. That's a classic franchise relationship where the signage is the same, the menu is the same, it's important that burgers are cooked the same way, the fries are cooked the same way, and that there are very strong controls in place so that consistency occurs. That consistency does not mean that that corporate entity controls that franchisee, and we're going to hear about that today. As I indicated, the courts have supported this franchise relationship that has existed in law for a number of years, but for some reason, the Oregon Employment Department has said that the law is too vague, and they have drawn contrary conclusions. Joining me today is Jeff Freeman, who's the CEO of Janet King in Oregon, who is the master franchisee. Also joining me is Pauline Perez, who is a franchisee, an independent business owner. And then finally, to answer some questions about what the bill is intended to do, is Jerry Webb, as Representative McLean said, is an attorney with Stoll Reeves. We are not asking you to right a wrong, to pass a bill to fix an individual situation. What we're asking you is to give businesses certainty into the future. It is this certainty that's important to Oregon small businesses and to our state's economy. So I'll turn it over to Jeff Freeman now. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for having us this morning. I know you're all really busy people, so I just want to share with you what happened with our business. I opened our Janet King. I purchased Janet King from our head office in Dallas, Texas in 1994, and started developing our unit franchise owners here in Oregon, Southwest Washington. And for almost 20 years now, we've helped about 100 small business people start franchises here in Oregon and employ people. And the reason people buy franchises, as many probably know, is that it has a model, a business system that can help people be successful in achieving their part.
Excuse me, sir, could you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Jeff Freeman. And Madam Chair, I'm the and committee members, I'm the local owner of Janet King in Oregon in Southwest Washington.
Thank you very much.
And so I, as I mentioned, opened our business, and at that point we started developing our franchise system here in Oregon. We have helped 100 small business people, I think in some ways, buy their American dream by buying a Janet King franchise and becoming self-employed, where they've hired people. We deliver to the business community a system that is one in which there's a brand that they can trust by using Janet King that's actually a worldwide brand. And then in 2011, I suddenly got a notice from the Employment Department that we were going to go under an audit. And going through that process for the last couple of years has been something of an ordeal. We did resolve that, at least in the short term, but we still have some uncertainty in where our franchise system fits into the laws related to what the employment laws are here in Oregon. And the direction that we received from the agency was, well, you should probably take your case to the legislature, and that's what we're doing now, is to get some certainty, because we're in a position, in my particular case, we haven't sold franchises for 2 years. We've stopped helping people open up their own businesses because we don't know where we stand. And so we're asking this committee to not only help maybe the situation I have, but there are other franchise companies out there that might be in the same boat, looking to say, you know, are we employers? Are we not employers? And I believe the people that have bought our franchises, such as Mrs. Pauline Perez here, they don't want to be employees. They bought their business because they want to work for themselves. So thank you for hearing me this morning. I think Mr. Jarman and Representative McLean, as well as Mr. Webb, have put together good information that I hope you'll take and I'm sure would read thoroughly. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to introduce Pauline Perez. She's our one of our local franchise owners here in Oregon.
And if you'll identify yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Pauline Perez with Jana King. I am a franchisee owner here in Oregon and Southwest Washington. I'm here because when Jeff had brought this to my attention, kind of shocked me. I was 18 years old when I started my franchise, bought a business, and I'm now 29 years old. I employ 13 people that I give opportunities to, and which in turn gives them opportunities that they don't have to be on unemployment, that they have a way to feed their family, that they have a way to take care of their children. And when he told me there was a possibility of that not being who I am, a business owner, somebody who helps other people, who puts myself out there to make sure that others have what they need, I was really upset. You know, I've put a lot of sweat, tears, countless nights of not sleeping, sometimes 72 hours straight because my operations supervisor has just quit, or somebody's gotten sick and I don't have somebody in place to take on that job. I'm the one that's right there working and taking care of it. I make all my own decisions. The only reason I chose to open a franchise is because I was reading Forbes one day at 17 years old, and they said that franchises have a 95% success rate because of the plan that they have. And I thought, you know what? I'm 17 years old, thinking about starting a business. Who's going to trust a 17-year-old kid? I walk into some of these facilities. Frito-Lay is one of my largest contracts. It's $125,000 a year that I get from that contract. If I was to walk in there at 18 years old and say, please hand me $125,000, they'd look at me and say, please walk out. So in turn, having Jana King behind me saying, you know, yes, we are a legitimate franchise. We have helped people understand a system that needs to happen to keep you guys safe, to keep your building running smooth and all this stuff. You know, that's the only reason I picked a franchise. I would have done it regardless, but Jana King has not ruled my business. I still make my own decisions. I hire and fire my own people. Some of the people that I have hired do have a history of things that maybe somebody else wouldn't have employed them for that reason. And that's been my choice. I'm responsible for them. And I love what I do. I don't want to lose this opportunity. You know, I work hard for what I have. And I enjoy the fact that just as last year, I was able to retire and spend time with my kids and be there for them full time and show other people that, you know, here, I'm here for you. I want to build this business, give you more work. I have a gentleman who works for me that was on drugs. He didn't have anything. And I had actually met him at one of my facilities. He was going to that church, and they were helping him get a place to live. And he is now my operations supervisor for Frito-Lay. And he has been running that company down there. We have a letter from Frito-Lay saying how much of a wonderful employee he is, how much of a wonderful contractor I am. You know, so this is just an opportunity, and I don't want to lose that. So I'm asking you that we could take a look at this bill and really put it where it needs to be so we don't have to worry about this again.
Yeah, thank you. Did you want to bring up Mr. Webb before
yes.
We asked questions? And after Mr. Webb speaks, and we'll ask questions. And Ms. Perez, we might bring you back up. So,
thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you. I'm Jerry Webb. I'm a partner with the law firm of Stoll Reeves in Portland. I've practiced in the franchise law field as well as other fields for approximately 30 years, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of HB 3095. I want to start out by saying that I have played basketball with Mike McLean, and he has one of the more amazing crossover dribbles that you'll ever see. He must have a hoop out there east of Redmond that he practices on. I want to start out by saying that I'm not really here because of Jeff Freeman, my client's problem, but it came to my attention. He's resolved his issues with the state, but as a result of that experience, I discovered this uncertainty in the Oregon law as it applies to taking the independent contractor employee test and applying it to franchising. So let me just say a couple things about franchising, because it's a unique business model. The first and most important point about franchising probably is that it's an avenue to the American dream for many small businesses. And the reason for that is, as Paula just said, your success opportunity in franchising, according to the statistics, are dramatically greater than if you start your own business. And the reasons for that are obvious. You have the backing of a national brand, and you have a proven system that you're implementing. So franchising has been around for about 50 years, and it's regulated in every state by the Federal Trade Commission under what's called a franchise rule, which requires an extensive disclosure document if you're going to sell a franchise. You know, it looks like a stock offering. It used to be called a Uniform Franchise Offering Circular. Now it's called a Federal Disclosure Document. In addition, at the state level, 15 states, and Oregon is one of these 15, regulate franchising extensively as well at the state level. So Jeff Freeman's company has to comply with Oregon law, very extensive disclosures required in connection with selling franchises. And franchise law, both as a matter of law and a matter of practice, requires extensive controls by the franchisor over the franchisee legally in order to have any trademark license, and a franchise is just a sophisticated version of a trademark license. The licensor, the franchisor, must exercise significant control over the franchisee in order to protect the reputation and uniformity of the brand. And in addition, as a practical matter, that's true as well, because that's the essence of franchising. If you go into McDonald's, you know that the experience you're going to get is the same in every McDonald's, and the reason for that is McDonald's controls every single aspect of how the franchisee does business. In fact, one of the ironies of the audit that we went through with the state is that McDonald's exercises dramatically more control over their franchisees than Jeff Freeman's company does. For his franchisees, they set the hours, they set the uniforms, they set the equipment you buy, they set the supplies you buy, they control every aspect of how you prepare the food. So that is what creates the dilemma that the employment department and other departments that apply this issue, because Oregon, like many states, has a somewhat vague standard that refers to exercising control over the manner and means that the work is done. I don't think anyone would appear in front of this committee and say that when the legislature adopted the Oregon statute, they intended franchisees to be employees of their franchisor. That's a crazy concept. And so we're just asking for what I believe is a simple clarification of Oregon law. Now, this issue has arisen in other states as well. I've submitted a letter to the committee. I hope that committee members either have or will this read this, because it lays out the background of the statute. But I want to mention that this exact issue has come up in several states already, and two states have adopted a solution of precisely the issue that we're talking about here today. I'd like to read the...
If this is in the written testimony, we have the written testimony. If you could just summarize it, please.
Yes. I just want to say that the Georgia Code is a good example of this. It's one sentence. Individuals who are parties to a franchise agreement as set out by the Federal Trade Commission shall not be deemed employees for purposes of this chapter. That's the solution that has been implemented in some other states that are ahead of us in identifying this problem. And the bill that we've offered here to this committee, in somewhat similar words, would resolve the issue as well. So in concluding, I would just say I regard this as a simple clarification of existing law, not a change in the law, but just a clarification to let franchisees and franchisors know that they are legal to operate in the state of Oregon, as we have thought all these years that they are. Thank you.
Okay, questions for the panelists? Representative Borden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just let me outline a bit of context for you. This is your first time, I believe, coming up in front of this committee. And then ask a question, perhaps at you, Mr. Webb. Now, first, you know, this committee is actually very familiar with this issue, with this debate. In fact, we've already heard about six or so bills this session. We hear them every session. about the employee versus independent contractor test. Typically, in fact, almost always, it's usually from a labor group that comes up, and they feel that what are, in effect, employees are being, they're treated like employees, but being paid like independent contractors. And I think everyone on this committee tends to be very sympathetic to that, but that's already, there already is the test. The law is relatively clear. It's one of enforcement and determination. And this body, I think most of us feel like, although sympathetic, is not well equipped to make those kind of fact-based determinations or enforcement of abuse of that statute. In effect, you're coming in from the other side on this one bill and saying, hey, we really are independent contractors. We're being now treated like employees. But again, perhaps all of us are sympathetic, but the law is relatively clear on point. There are remedies if the agency makes that kind of fact determination, gets it wrong. And I gather it's already been sorted out. What happened in this case? Did you appeal? But
yeah. Madam Chair, I'm representing Barton. I think what you're saying is there are remedies through the court system
right.
if the agencies get it wrong, but as a practical matter, that doesn't exist for businesses. And let me see if I can spell it out procedurally. In order to challenge the state on a determination like this, you would have to spend 2 or 3 years in court and several hundred thousand dollars in legal fees against an uncertain result that's generated by a vague statute. And if you win, you don't recover your attorney's fees. If you lose, you not only are paying the assessment that they are saying that you owe, but you're paying interest and penalties for the entire period of time of your appeal. So as a practical matter, the typical small business cannot go through that process. It would bankrupt the business in many cases. And this is an issue that, let me back up and say, franchising is a very, very peculiar subset of what you've mentioned. I realize that this issue is coming up across all industries, and I want to say something, having been a lawyer over many years that has dealt with this issue outside of franchising in some cases. It's very apparent that you have businesses that are going into what we might call the gray area, and they know they're trying to avoid having people that they're paying to provide services be employees for the obvious advantages of avoiding certain taxes, and they know they're in the gray area. They may even get legal advice on that. That's not this situation. In this situation, Jeff Freeman, has gotten high-priced legal advice on this issue. He's been told that he's you know, a typical franchise. He's perfectly legal to operate in this state and other states. He's not somebody who's trying to bend the law to get into the gray area. He thought he was squeaky clean because he's a franchise, and it was a great surprise to him and to the rest of us have dealt with the situation that, in fact, that's not clear, and that at least the Oregon departments have taken a contrary position, which has then raised the issue of franchising generally, and that's why we're in front of you today.
Okay. Other questions, Mr. Wendt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will we be hearing from the Employment Department today?
We do have the Employment Department here today. If you have questions, they're not signed up to speak.
They're not signed up?
No. Wait here if you have any questions, unless they want to.
I do have a question, Madam Chair, for the department.
So when we finish this panel, we'll bring up the employment.
Thank you.
Folks. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Excuse me. Jerry, what do you think is the impetus for this change in enforcement by the Employment Department? What do you see as having changed that suddenly in 2011 they're getting this assessment that there are, or this, I guess, yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I don't know the answer to that question. If you were cynical, you would say it would be an ill-advised effort to find monies because these audits bring in a lot of money to the state. It's very common to audit businesses. I was audited myself because I had a bookkeeper that worked for me, and she only worked for me, and passed that audit with flying colors, no problem. But the auditor told me, we almost never have this result, which is a finding that you're okay, and this person is not an employee. Our hit rate is like 95%. So I think you get the state can get a lot of money in this. The new thing is taking it into the franchise realm. That's really a very new thing. As I said, this model has been in Oregon for 20 years. The employment department for 20 years thought there was no problem with this business model. They didn't put out any advisory opinions. They didn't have an enforcement published policy that would tell somebody in franchising that, holy, you actually may have a problem here, even though you've been around for a long time. So this is new, this concept of attacking franchising as an industry.
Okay, Representative Holby.
Thank you. I appreciate this conversation, Mr. Webb. Like Representative Barton has said, you know, we've had a lot of discussion about independent contractors over the years, and I guess my one concern about this bill is just to is that it just generally labels if you consider if you're a franchisee, you're not an employee, and I worry that may actually open up a gaping loophole, and that every employee will figure out how to be considered a franchisee in the future. And so when I look at the definition of franchisor, franchise, and franchisee, it seems to me that, you know, they need to take into consideration what the independent contractor definition is and try to describe franchisees so that they clearly are independent contractors under that law, or try to make those two laws come together, because the way the bill's written is just a blanket. If you're a franchisee, you're not an employee, essentially. And I think there needs to be, as Representative Barton maybe suggested, a little work done on trying to refine, bringing those two sections of law together so that they're consistent.
If I could have a question, maybe you guys can answer it. Ms. Perez, do you pay unemployment and all of that for your employees? Okay. How many employees do you have, and do you pay unemployment for them?
Yes, Madam Chair. I have 10 employees, and I pay all the withholding.
Okay. And so the issue is whether you have to pay unemployment for Ms. Perez, who bought the franchise. Is that what the issue is?
Yes, Madam Chair.
The lack of clarity? Okay.
Yes.
Madam Chair and Representative Holbert, you've made a very good point, and I actually anticipated that in drafting this bill. Unlike the statute I read from Oklahoma, which would, in a blanket fashion, say that if you're a qualifying franchise, you cannot be an employee, this bill doesn't do that. It allows for exactly what you said. It only provides that you cannot be classified as an employee unless you're exercising controls that go beyond those that are customary in franchising and protect the goodwill of the trademark. So that leaves the employment department and the other departments free to, in your hypothetical, somebody who tries to avoid the laws by creating some, you know, bizarre form of franchising that goes beyond those customary kind of controls, they could still be classified as employees and life would go on.
Okay. Any other follow-up questions? We're running. These guys have got about another 5 minutes for the presentation. We still have Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, I am a little bit nervous about the definition of what's customary and what is not. So, you know, I think that's the issue.
And I think that's noted and something that needs to be worked on. Other, Ms. Fagan?
Just kind of, I think, more of a comment in response to you, Madam Chair, because I see it as bigger than just whether Jana King pays for Ms. Perez's unemployment. If Ms. Perez is, in fact, an employee, then the 13 people under her are actually employees of Jana King and not her. So it's actually, so as I see it, it's not about just the individual franchise owner. It's actually everyone under them, is not actually, the lack of clarity is that whether or not they are employees of Ms. Perez or whether they're employees of Jana King, which I understand for you would then create much more than 10 employees for you, I would imagine. So I see there's a little bit bigger issue than just the one franchisor.
Question?
Well, I'm just wondering, would this mean Ms. Perez could sue the state to get all of her money back for unemployment?
I'm not a lawyer. Was that a question or a hypothetical?
Well, it's kind of a little bit of both, but I mean, if we're going to don't get this definition and get this cleared up, I mean, she would have legal action basically back against the state for everything she's paid in unemployment benefits.
Okay. Any other questions of the panelists? Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
We do have J.L. Wilson, then also, did the Employment Division want to come in? Come on up. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, J.L. Wilson with Associated Oregon Industries. Just very briefly, AOI supports this bill. We think it's a very important concept that basically says that except in extenuating circumstances, the customary franchisor-franchisee relationship does not constitute an employment relationship between the two. And I don't think that there's ever been any contemplation with this body or the franchisor community or franchisees that a franchise agreement actually constitutes an employment relationship. So we support the bill and would appreciate your work in moving it forward.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I ask a question, please? Thank you, Madam Chair. JL, other instances of this change of policy where others are being franchisees or being labeled as employees?
Thank you. We're aware of the Janet King situation, and that's what sort of precipitates our call for certainty with this issue. I'm not aware of others, Representative Kennemer.
Certainly is a slide if we're not careful. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions of Mr. Wilson? Okay, Mr. Gershfeld.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm David Gerstenfeld, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Oregon Employment Department. And I understand that there are some questions. Certainly happy to answer those questions about this bill. I did want to make just a few comments based on what I've heard. To clarify that the Employment Department certainly isn't attacking franchise arrangements or saying that those aren't lawful in the state of Oregon. What we do when we're looking at these situations is deciding whether the payments that were made are subject to the unemployment insurance tax for the business, and whether for the individual who received the payments, whether those can help that person qualify for unemployment insurance benefits. When we do that, we are typically looking at the independent contractor test and applying that across all business models and all structures, and applying those standards, whether it's a franchisee-franchisor relationship or some other type of legal structure that we're applying it to. And I understand that there are some specific questions.
Okay. Are there any questions of Mr. Gershenfeld? Representative Witt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gerstenfeld, you may or may not be familiar with the specifics of this case, but my main question was whether, in fact, you had applied the test for independent contractor.
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, and I'm not familiar with all of the details of this case and feel a little uncomfortable talking about specifics because we do treat the confidentiality of the information we receive seriously. I can certainly follow up. Whenever we're looking at a situation like this, though, where someone says we don't think that this was subject to the tax, we do look at the statutory exemptions, and the independent contractor exemption is the one that comes up most frequently and that we certainly look at whenever the facts raise it, whether the business asserts it or not.
Madam Chair, I'm just curious whether there is an underlying cause why we are hearing, as Representative Barton suggested, more from the employer side of the equation about complaints here than we typically might expect. I'm just curious. We could pass a law and have precisely the problems that Representative Holvey described, and I'm concerned about that. But I'm also concerned what if anything has caused what appears to be some kind of change here in terms of going after independent distributors. We heard testimony that was problematic here a couple of weeks ago, and now franchisees. I'd be interested in hearing more information about this.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kennemer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess consistent with Representative Watt's comments, it seems to be implied that there's a change in interpretation or policy by the Employment Department, and I guess I'd ask that question. And so I think there's long-standing case law and experience in this area, and it seems to me an exception and a remarkable statement to attack a franchisee this directly.
Chair Doherty,
at least as I see it thus far, and I certainly don't have all the details.
Certainly. Representative Kenneber and Representative Wood, I think this addresses your question as well. The Employment Department has not changed its policy, and we don't see this as a change. We apply the independent contractor analysis. When that statute changes, we, of course, modify. To address the issue of why there might be more situations being brought to this committee's attention, we've looked at this within Oregon and nationally, and a couple of the trends that we've seen is during the economic recession, a lot of people filed for unemployment insurance benefits that had not in the past. Whenever someone files a claim for benefits and says, I think I'm entitled to benefits, we look at their earnings history. And if we see that they did not have wages reported, that can raise an issue as to whether they were an employee for purposes of unemployment insurance benefits. So whenever you have a large rise in the number of unemployment insurance claims, that can bring about a look at other businesses and other business models. The other trend that we've seen is a push for businesses to explore alternate business models to respond to the economic conditions. So I'm certainly not saying that either of those was the case in this particular situation, but in answering the broader question of why there might be more of these questions about exemptions or perceived changes of how the law is applied, I think that may be part of the answer. The other issue is that when we're hearing about some business models that have been in place for instance, 20 years, the independent contractor statutes have changed in Oregon several times over the course of that 20-year period. So that does necessitate a change of how we apply that. Certainly many times it doesn't change the outcome for a lot of business structures.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Any follow-up? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, that's the last person we have signed up. Do we have anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? Okay, thank you very much. So I close the public hearing on House Bill 3095 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3026. Representative Gallegos.
You better fix it.
I'm reading these six pages. Yeah. Sir Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, I am Joseph Gallegos, and I represent District 30, which includes City of Hillsborough, part of the City of Hillsborough, North Plains, and unincorporated Washington County. And I really am a representative, despite the fact I lost my pen. I was duly
we all do that.
By Ramona for yeah. that. This is a great little bill. It's a refinement of something that's already policy that's already been passed by the House, I think, a couple of sessions ago. This is really a pro-business, pro-family bill, and I'd like to start out with probably a little personal story that will set the context for this presentation. It's about support for family leave, particularly extending the family leave policy to include siblings, basically. And so I wanted to think about yourself, your own families, and maybe sometime when you were ill or another member of your family was ill and you had somebody in your family, a sibling, sister, or brother, more likely a sister. Unlikely a brother, but taking care of the person who was ill. And well, it was a long time ago, but when I was a kid, we were working in picking tomatoes out in Kokomo, Indiana, of all places. And I picked up a rash on a pesticide on the back of my leg, and I literally couldn't bend my leg. And my mother had found a local doctor to provide some medication, so they took care of me that way, but I had to stay in the, we were living in a cabin actually, and the rest of the family continued to go to work. But I stayed by myself. I mean, I was like, I don't know, 9, 10 years old, for several days while my the rash healed and so on. But my point being that today there's laws against that. That would be probably not abuse, but certainly child neglect. And
we've moved beyond that kind of thing. So we have laws now to protect children, to provide support for families that need help in terms of providing care for someone that needs a safe home. The other idea I'd like to present is the families have changed, and families are developing, families are evolving, and it isn't so much that we have the same kind of family that we used to have, where women stayed home and were there to provide care for anybody that got ill. More and more, both parents are working, and now even older siblings are working as well. So this bill wants to address the issues of working families. There was a recent study that just came out actually in January from Rutgers University, and it was a 10-year study and documents then the whole notion that providing family care and supporting families, working families in this way, is really good for business. It helps people to develop loyalty to their business, to the place of work, and so on. So that's really the message that I wanted to share with you. And you've got some written testimony in front of you. But like I said, just to be brief, that's what this bill is about. And I encourage you to pass it.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of the representative? Even though he doesn't have his pen, we all lose them. So. Anyway, thank you very much. In fact, Jan, if you could summarize some of the specifics of the bill that we have in the...
Madam Chair, committee members, it does bring siblings under the definition of a family member. And I would just say that the Oregon OFLA, the Oregon Family Leave Act, is employers who are subject are those who are employing 25 or more persons in Oregon. And an eligible employee would be one who has worked for at least 180 days for the employer and an average of 25 hours per week for that employer.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. No questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I just want to add that next year or next session we'll bring one in to add mothers-in-laws, I think. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, we have two more people on the list, J.L. Wilson and Jan Meekums. We may all like to know that mothers-in-law are covered.
Ah, you just stole my thunder, Madam Chair.
Sorry. Which they should be.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industry. What do I have, 25 minutes?
Absolutely.
Okay. There's a reason I have to trudge up here and oppose bills like this, and believe me, I don't relish it. But I just I want to be clear about OFLA, the state family leave law, as it relates to the federal family leave law. Now, people say, well, there's not a real administrative burden. You know, that might be for companies with 25 to 49 employees, but for those that have to administer both laws, both OFLA and FEMLA, I just want to run you through what a bill like this means. Okay, so we add siblings into the definition for family leave in Oregon. There's only one other state that does that. That's the state of Maine. The main difference between Maine and Oregon is that Maine's family leave overlay law, similar to our OFLA, gives 10 weeks of leave over the course of 2 years. In Oregon, there's a pathway to 12 to 24 weeks in one calendar year. So there's a huge, huge difference. When you talk about adding siblings as part of OFLA, and it says you have to give 12 weeks under this law, you effectively have to double that if you're an employer who's covered under OFLA and FEMLA. And the reason I say that is if you access OFLA leave because you're caring for a sibling, that does not count against your federal time, your federal family leave time off. So you're essentially, you might run through your 12 weeks of OFLA to care for a sibling, but your full 12-week bank of FEMLA is still intact. So a 12-week leave then becomes 24 if you're administering both OFLA and FEMLA. And then what happens with regard to
how the law is administered. If you're an Oregon employer and you're covered under both OFLA and FEMLA, you have issues of reinstatement. FEMLA allows you to reinstate to an equivalent position. OFLA does not allow you to reinstate into an equivalent position. It has to be the exact position. Reassignment. You may take leave for a sibling on an hour-by-hour basis, known as intermittent leave. Federal law allows you to reassign somebody to an equivalent position and to better absorb the disruption in the workplace that the intermittent leave might cause. OFLA does not allow you to do that, so that is an additional regulatory issue that's opened up. Federal law allows you to deduct salary for partial day absences. OFLA does not, so there's another disparity between FEMLA and OFLA as it relates to this issue. You also have issues regarding timely notice. FEMLA, the federal law, requires a timely notice. OFLA has a conflicting regulation. The reality in Oregon is you can't enforce both. You can't enforce either of them because the two conflict. You have employer contact with health care provider issues that basically OFLA precludes contact with health care providers, so you can't do that if you open up 12 weeks of leave for sibling care. And then you have the issue of employer questioning. Does an employer have a right to question you on your leave? You have those rights under FEMLA. You do not have those rights under OFLA, so this is yet another regulatory issue that's opened up with a bill like House Bill 3026. The point is not to rail on the bill, because you look at our family leave and you would simply ask, why are siblings not included? I totally get it. But I want to, my point is to say there are a number of regulatory issues that follow when you start to open up OFLA statutes, especially if you've got an employer that has to administer both OFLA and the federal law, and you're talking about any employer in this state with 50 employees or more, and then you start to see the regulatory issues that ensue, and that's why we get concerned about it.
Okay, thank you. Jim?
Chair Doherty and members of the committee, my name is Jan Meekums, the State Director for National Federation of Independent Business, representing about 7,500 small businesses in the state of Oregon. And I don't want to take up your valuable time, but obviously we concur with everything that J.L. Wilson has said that is of our concern, and the fact that this is much more generous than the federal law, and by adding the sibling, it adds to that as well. And it's not any one thing that is become such a problem for our small business. It's the accumulation of a mandate here, a mandate there, and pretty soon we have a behemoth situation of regulatory burden that our employers are trying to abide by. And for that reason, we ask that you consider opposing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of the panelists? Representative Widener?
Do you think AOI and NFIB would be supportive if all the legislative members actually took advantage of this and didn't show up for the session?
No comment.
Well, thank you. Representative Doherty, Representative Widener, I think I'm going to use your opportunity to make a real point here. The one thing that we've asked for, and we asked for in the bereavement leave issue, sometimes it's time to take a step back and develop, we call it strategic planning in the private sector. What is the strategic plan around our family leave law? What are the policy objectives we're trying to accomplish? And my point previously, if we're trying to grant, we want to grant bereavement leave, we want to grant siblings, then how do you construct a whole system that can grant these types of things but still keep it in a place where employers can administer it more easily than they're able to today? So, we call it strategic planning on the private side. I want nothing more to engage in a strategic planning process as it relates to family leave in the state, because it has been basically a process by sedimentation. We add and add and add and add, and now we have a system in today that is really an outlier among the 50 states. And it's not that we want to make it so it applies only to big businesses, and we want to reduce the family members on. I understand that those are policy objectives that this legislature wants to meet, but we have to talk about the regulatory for how do you administer both OFLA and FEMLA in this state mm-hmm. in a way that makes it easier for employers to administer. That's our primary concern, and we'd love to engage in that process.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Fagan?
Just kind of for a point for clarification, although I think, Mr. Wilson, you make a really good point, something I'd actually never thought of, even though I've practiced employment law, the idea of 24 weeks. So OFLA leave does count towards FEMLA leave in the law for a qualifying absence that's covered under both. So it's, for example, you know, a woman having a baby is a good example. If it's a qualifying leave for OFLA and FEMLA, 12 weeks is the max.
Correct.
But you do bring up a great point that has just never occurred to me, that in the extent that we expand OFLA to categories not covered by FEMLA, then, and FEMLA being family medical leave, sorry to speak in weird syllables, that somebody, you know, would take 12 weeks for a brother or sister under OFLA, and then but that does not count towards FEMLA, and then later, I just want to acknowledge it's a great point that you bring up, and something I've never actually considered as we expand. Not necessarily mean I oppose the bill, but that might be something that should be worked out, because I don't know that that's an intention of the legislature when we create new areas in OFLA. I've never intended to then create 24 weeks. I've always still intended to limit it to 12 weeks. I think it might be an oversight that would be something that we could look into working on.
Would you like a copy of this tape so you have it for the record?
We can YouTube this and you can share it on your Facebook.
You came up enough. Any other questions of the panelists?
Thank you very much. Ms. Bodkin, did you want to come up?
Yeah, is Ilana coming up also or just you? Oh, Ilana, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mary Bodkin with AFSCME for the record. Representative Fagan absolutely just articulated everything that Ilana and I were chatting about in the back of the room. And we would like to suggest that perhaps we postpone the hearing on this bill and give us a chance to sit down with JL and the opponents and see if there's some way to resolve this, because I don't think I never thought about the 24-week issue before, and I don't think that was our intent. I'm pretty sure it probably was not Representative Gallego's intent either. So,
exactly.
You know, I think we could work something out.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, Ilana Guinea with the AFL-CIO. Thank you, Representative Fagan, for suggesting that oversight didn't need to kill this concept, because we do believe that it's important for any Oregonian to have the ability to care for a family member who is important to them. And if you don't have children, don't have a spouse, the person you're going to turn to when you need care is likely going to be a sibling. We want to make sure that we can protect those people without doing something we weren't intending to do. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for the offer. Any questions or... Okay, thank you for the offer, and
thanks.
I'm sure that Mr. Wilson and others will take up on you, and maybe Representative Fagan would like to get involved also.
That'd be nice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, that was the last person signed up for House Bill 3026.
Quick breather.
We also did have written testimony from the chief sponsor, Representative Chris Gorsuch. So I close the public hearing on House Bill 3026 and take a little bit of a pause as we dial the phone. And actually, if Sybil, Kristen, and Christina would like to come up.
So it's almost like we need to seek a federal waiver of their situation.
And Christina Dirksen is by phone.
You legally can.
So when we get her on the phone, we'll begin the hearing.
Yes. You can't by state law say you're going to get that federal leave for qualifying circumstances. That's interesting.
The other issue, you have to give people 52 weeks of
family leave. I'm not. I'm getting there.
After a while, to get out of the job.
But you got to throw the slot.
Yeah.
Technology.
Jobs,
that's tough. You've got a skilled person. Give it one more try here. Do a summary when you're done. We're not getting her.
We're not getting a...
Are you not getting in, or...?
I'm not getting in.
Check with your caucus. I could have you call directly with her cell phone number if that's useful.
Does she have written testimony that we can just submit, or...?
She doesn't. I can have her do that.
Okay. Because actually, we're going to just continue panels down because everyone is for this legislation.
You know, the 12th time's the charm.
That's right. You spoke too soon. That kind of
stuff. Madam Chair, would this be an opportunity for me to ruminate and make a comment about this bill?
Sure.
So, you know, I gather everyone is coming to testify in favor of this bill. I strongly suspect that on reading the bill, every one of us here love the idea. Obviously, it's a great one. There's just a way that this legislature looks at issues that has, there's a structural flaw in that each and every one of the issues or notices that are required to be posted is a good idea. That's why this legislature passes them. However, if the sum total renders them all relatively ineffective. When, let's pretend we had 100 things posted, no one of which becomes very effective. So there's always that tension that a tragedy of the commons that I think we have to be, where's that limit? At what point do we need to start removing one for every one we add? I don't know, I don't have answers to those questions, but I think it's incumbent upon us to reflect on that.
Thank you.
That's all.
Well, I think we're going to start with the testimony. We're not be able to do that because, as I say, we've got 8 people.
Thank you.
So if you'd like to begin. And actually, before we do that, Jan, if you could read the summary of the bill, please.
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill requires an employer who employs 6 or more individuals to post a summary of the statutes and any related rules regarding employment rights of victims of domestic violence, harassment, sexual assault, or stalking. It also modifies the definition of an eligible employee by deleting the requirement that the employee must have worked a specified minimum number of hours and days. There are no amendments.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair Dougherty, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here in support of House Bill 2903. I'm also speaking today on behalf of the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women in support of the bill. I really appreciate your efforts to dial in our witness, and we'll be sure to provide you with written testimony.
Thank you.
In substitution for that. As you all know, the Oregon Law Center's mission is to provide access to justice for vulnerable low-income Oregonians. A significant number of our cases and an increasing number of our cases and requests for assistance are coming from people who are survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault, and they are grappling with the immense impact that has on their lives. And we try to help them take safety steps. We refer them to work with domestic violence advocates at local shelters and hotlines, try to provide them with resources that help them get to safety, and we help them achieve restraining orders or stalking order protections where that is a needed and necessary protection. And we often find that there is a tension between a victim's ability to come forward and seek our help and seek the help of the courts or of law enforcement because of work schedules. And when a victim is seeking to establish safety and separation from an abusive partner, the economic independence and economic stability that is offered by a job is of critical importance in terms of that person's ability to alone now support a family, other dependent members, and remain safe. Often getting safe requires expenditures, changing locks, repairing holes in windows, and that sort of thing, moving expenses. And so a job is of increasing importance when this crisis is going on. The concern that victims have about taking steps to go access safety if there are potential job consequences are an untenable situation. We don't want people in our state having to face that choice of, do I take the steps I need to protect myself and my children, or do I lose my job? And this law is, this 2903 is something that is addressing two small gaps in what is current protection. Oregon, the Oregon legislature, with overwhelming bipartisan support in 2007, took a great step forward to address this dynamic by providing protection that is currently available under 659A.270 and related statutes. And that's been in place for since 2007. It has worked really well where victims are aware of the relief and where they are able to access it. The gap that we are finding is that some victims don't know that they are able to take this relief, to take this step, and others do not qualify because they have not worked for a sufficient period of time for that employer so that they are eligible. And our current law precludes people from qualifying if they have not worked for 180 days for a minimum number of hours. And this bill comes to you because of stories and concerns that we have seen from clients who have come to our offices and also from reports that we have heard from the domestic violence shelters. The numbers are not large, but where this gap exists, the impact on victims and on the employment environment is of critical importance. We know, unfortunately, that domestic and sexual violence in the state of Oregon are a huge public health and safety concern. The Director of Public Health, Dr. Mel Cohn, has submitted testimony that I believe you have before you in support of this bill. Oregon, just briefly, is unfortunately kind of at the top of the nation. We're number two in our rates of sexual violence. We are higher than the rest of the nation in terms of the impact that the fatality rates that domestic violence causes in our state. So this is a critical issue. Not only the health and safety to victims, but also the attendant concerns that arise for children and family members that are living with victims. Suffering from this kind of abuse leads to increased substance abuse incidences, increased levels of physical health issues over a lifelong term. So it's in our best interest to try to help facilitate safety steps and to reduce barriers. We know that also...
if you could summarize, please.
Yes. Thank you, ma'am. The bill itself just makes two small fixes and to what is current law. It does not change the protections that exist for employers if the providing leave would be an undue burden on the employer. The employer is exempt from providing the leave. The leave is reasonable for specific safety-related purposes like getting a police, talking to police, getting medical assistance, seeking court assistance, and relocation. And the bill does not change the eligibility of employers who are covered. So it's just erasing the qualifying protection time. We know that domestic violence and sexual assault perpetrators don't wait until victims qualify for relief. And we know that when there is safety steps needed, that timing is of the essence, and people need to take the steps at that critical juncture. To address Representative Barton's question about posting, we agree that is not the silver bullet, but we do think that it helps, and we have seen in other states that it has made a difference. It's a very low cost to the employer. The Bureau of Labor and Industries provides the form. The employer can simply download it, and at least there is some accessibility. So we hope that it will be of help, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Kristen? Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Barton, Vice Chair Kahneman, and members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Heidel. I'm the Youth Services Coordinator for Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service and also an advocate. We work with victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and human trafficking, and we've been around since 1973 serving victims.
And we have your testimony if you just want to summarize your written testimony.
As an advocate working with victims, I see on a daily basis how this affects victims of all types of violence. One in three women in the United States will experience some type of violence in their lifetime. Being able to leave work is critical for victims. Oftentimes, abusers will use financial abuse in order to keep victims in a relationship along with all other forms of abuse. And so having a victim in being able to work, that is incredibly important to provide financial independence in the long run. just recently I was working with a woman who she works 8 to 5, and she's not able to leave work, and it takes more time to file temporary restraining orders, to apply for a domestic violence grant, to do extensive safety planning that are critical to victims. It takes more time than just doing that over the lunch hour. This woman has been trying to file a temporary restraining order so she can leave an abusive situation, but she has not been able to do that, and she has just been recently employed. Another woman, she's a young pregnant woman that I was just talking with on Friday, and she called in crisis because her boyfriend had strangled her the night before, and she wanted to file a temporary restraining order, but and asked her employer if she could have time off, and her employer insinuated that she would lose her job if she did so. So this bill is incredibly important. Just as one of the situations that I described in my testimony, oftentimes things that happen, if a woman files for a temporary restraining order, an abuser can contest that. And I've worked with quite a few women who have had their restraining order dropped because they have not been able to show up for a contestment hearing, which is really unfortunate. And this woman I described, she was very fearful that her boyfriend was going to murder her because he almost had before due to a severe strangulation. So I believe all victims deserve this right, not just victims that have been employed for longer than 180 days. And I think if Oregon were to pass this legislation, it would send a strong message to victims that Oregon supports victims and we don't tolerate violence. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions to the panelists? Because I also would like to point out, this is not just a female. There are 1 in 7
yes.
men are also
yes, and
victims of domestic abuse.
Apologize for that. Yes,
yeah. Representative Thatcher.
This might be just a more appropriate question for Boley, but it seems like with all the lovely wallpaper essentially that gets posted on the wall, it seems like it might be more convenient for a person to have a copy of these in their own possession. Maybe in addition to, it just seems like maybe, rather than requiring a person to memorize what was posted in the hallway or the lunchroom or wherever these things are posted, to actually maybe have a copy of these on hand and maybe make that an option as far as complying with a posting requirement in general, not just on this one, but in general, to, you know, allow for, you know, here's your book of stuff, you're hired, here's your stuff, and, you know, sign for it, we've given you your posting type of thing. Because a lot of jobs are mobile, they don't report to the office, they're going to, you know, directly out to a job where they're, you know, we're not going to put posters on the trees because they're outside and doing work there. It's kind of inconvenient for them. So I just wondered what your thoughts on that might be.
Well, real quickly, it is in the bill that upon request the person can get or that the text of what it is.
Well, I know, but I what I'm trying to say is in lieu of maybe allow that particular thing to not just be an option,
yeah.
but be an optional posting.
Okay. If you could quickly respond to that. We've got 8 more people to go in 20 minutes.
Chair Daugherty, Representative Thatcher, yes. I think it is important to have a posting just so that there's something consistently there, but the Bureau of Labor and Industries has worked really well with us and with some of the domestic violence advocates to create brochures on their websites, and the posting will direct people to that website, so there are brochures that can be downloaded.
One follow-up, too. Mm-hmm. How long do you anticipate these summaries to be? Because it sounds like a summary of the law and the rules.
Chair Daugherty, Representative Thatcher, they're to be summarized, and then you can get an access to the actual statute upon request. And the brochure is probably about a page and a half long, I would say. It's a triple fold.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Emily Collins, Mike Wells, and Aaron Greenswald. And Senator Thompson. In fact, Senator Thompson, if you'd like to, you've been so patiently waiting this morning, if you'd like to begin.
Good morning, committee. Chair Daugherty, Vice Chair Barton, and the rest of the committee. Mike told me last week he was going to be Mike Wells. I'm here.
You need to identify yourself, please.
I'm sorry. Senator Chuck Thompson, District 26. Mike asked me last week, he told me he was coming down to testify. I said, well, I'd gladly introduce you. Mike's a very good friend of mine and a constituent. I said, yeah, sure, I'll come down. So I got a text this weekend that said 8 o'clock on Monday. I'm a state senator. We don't get here till 10 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the morning. So anyway, I'm here with Mike.
Thank you very much.
I've met Mike a couple of years ago. Great guy. Lives in Sandy now. Has business up in the Welch's area. Astute businessman. And he has a passion that I've learned and learned from Mike about domestic violence and women's issues. And I just wanted to be here to support him and introduce him today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Wells, you know, beware of the company you keep.
Yeah.
I've been hearing that fairly steadily this morning since 8 a.m., I believe. Chair Doherty and representatives, I appreciate the chance to be here. My name is Mike Wells, as Chuck said. My wife and I have three businesses that we operate, primarily in senior housing in the east end of the Clackamas County. We started donating housing for use of Clackamas Women Services some 15 years ago, and every year since, we find that the job is bigger than we had previously known, and that it takes more, requires more, and the overall total is still going uphill instead of down, you know. As you probably already know, intimate partner violence in the United States has killed 2.5 times more than the Iraq and Afghanistan war combined in the same period. And this war on women and children is right down the street from here. It's right across town. And it's in your community, and it's in my community. Business is already paying a great deal of cost for domestic violence, and an awful lot of the time they don't know it, especially in small business. I can recall 35 years ago as a young employer thinking that what our employees used for adult beverages and recreational drugs on their own time was none of our business, and we've all seen how wrong that was. Happily, a great deal of businesses are now learning that knowing what their employees are facing as far as domestic violence and stalking is definitely a cost item. The efficiency that our survivors face in the judicial system is almost, we shouldn't be putting that word in the same context. I won't bore you with the details of what Clackamas County uses as how you get a restraining order, mm-hmm. But if I had to do this starting this morning, I don't think I'd be done by Wednesday afternoon. So the cost to the survivors is time off of work, and it's a simple thing to do. It's simple for the employers. It's little to no cost, and we're all stressing working as a team, and these teams all know what's going on with each other, and they care greatly, and they work better when they know their counterpart is getting aid. My only reservation with this bill is I've had 5 or 6 conversations in the last year with small business people like myself, and for the most part, they don't know what was in the original bill from 2007. So just the businesses that don't have an HR department need a way to deal with this, and they need to know where to call and where to go for help. And I appreciate your time for hearing this. Thank you
very much. We'll suggest that to Boley. Thank you very much, Nick.
See you.
And if you have written testimony, if you could just summarize it. Thank you.
Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Barton, Vice Chair Kenemer, members of the committee. My name is Emily Collins. I'm the Salem Police Department's Domestic Violence Victim Advocate, but I'm actually here on behalf of Deputy Chief Steve Velshaw. Normally, for something as important as this, he'd likes to be here himself. However, his daughter is swearing in today as a new CSO for the Salem Police Department, so he had to be there on her behalf. But I want to speak briefly to the importance of this bill. To give you an idea of the magnitude of the epidemic of violence in our community, I've been employed for the Salem Police Department as a full-time victim advocate for over 7 years. I also have 12 volunteer advocates. We go out 24/7 to provide services to victims in our community. We serve over 600 victims every year. That just tells you how important this issue is to the Salem Police Department to have a full-time employed victim advocate in addition to our officers going out and taking these types of calls. With your permission, I'd like to read verbatim what Deputy Chief Bell
Shaw. If you could just summarize. We've got 10 minutes. We have three more people that we need to hear from.
Let me see. Part of what gives victims a voice, oftentimes the abuser is the only one with the voice in the relationship. Victims don't have a choice. They don't have an opinion. They don't have a voice. But what can give them a voice is an option of a restraining order. It's not by itself necessarily a good safety plan alone, but it does offer tools for law enforcement to be able to hold offenders accountable. Also offers tools for workplaces where victims are going when they're not in the home to also help hold offenders accountable. What this does is it allows victims to take a step towards saying that this is not okay. It allows employers to take a step for their employees to say this is not okay, we're not going to allow this to happen. It ensures that victims, what this bill does is it ensures victims get the help when they need it. Victims don't get to choose when they get abused. Suspects choose when they're going to abuse their victims. And so what that means is victims don't get to choose when they get medical attention. They don't get to choose when they need a restraining order because they don't get to choose when they're abused. And so when they have to wait 180 days in order to go get a restraining order to get medical attention, it's really not best services for that victim. So what this bill does is encourage victims to not accept the violence. It encourages employers to not accept the violence, and it encourages the community to not accept the violence. So thank you for letting me share Deputy Chief Belshaw's opinions as well as my own, and I encourage you to support the passage of House Bill 2903.
Thank you so very much. The other Erin.
Hello. Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Barton, Vice Chair Kinnemer, members of the committee. My name is Erin Greenewald. I'm an attorney at the Department of Justice, specifically as it relates to why I'm here. I'm the Domestic Violence Resource Prosecutor for the Criminal Justice Division. Prior to this position, however, I was a Domestic Violence Prosecutor in both Marion and Yamhill County. For the entirety of my 15 years as a prosecutor, I've really devoted myself to the prosecution of domestic violence and other persons' felonies, including sexual assault of children and adults, homicides, kidnappings, robberies. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Justice to urge and testify in support of House Bill 2903. I'm not going to take too much of your time. I would reiterate what all the other witnesses have testified to. As this committee is, as I'm sure well aware, domestic violence is a pattern of behavior that results in basically a web of barriers being created for persons who are abused. It's a web of barriers created by the abuser and by the abusive situation. And the types of barriers that are created are really infinite. They sort of defy imagination. One of the most common that I have had, that I've seen, is the financial abuse and the financial barriers. And that comes from sometimes an abuser not allowing the victim to work. It also comes from an abuser forcing the victim to work, taking that money so that that person has no financial independence whatsoever. One of the ways that we can help victims access the court system, access safety, is taking away some of those barriers. I can't tell you the number of times in dealing with the hundreds and probably thousands of victims that I've talked to that they've not been able to meet with me. They've not been able to come to grand jury. They've not been able to do trial preparation or even come to trial or to bring their child to speak with me who's witnessed domestic violence because they can't take time off of work because they're fearful that their abuser is going to find out or that they're going to lose their job. This creates a huge problem for prosecutors and law enforcement when we're trying to hold these offenders accountable. The modifications made to this bill will help the criminal justice system hold abusers and offenders accountable and, more importantly, perhaps provide a mechanism of safety that victims don't currently have. So I thank you for your time, and I urge your support of this bill.
Okay. Do we have any questions? Representative Widener, we still have two other people to speak also.
Well, since we have a prosecutor up here, I'm not a big fan of postings. I mean, because like we've heard, it becomes wallpaper on the wall and nobody really notices it or ever pays attention to it. but I'm wondering what steps we really need to put in place if someone files a restraining order. Obviously, it's a bad situation, and they need protections to be able to go meet with you, do whatever they need to. So once this process starts, how many trips would they need to make to the courtroom if they filed a restraining order?
Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, thank you. And I can certainly answer this, and Ms. Collins can too. The restraining order is actually not a criminal act or a criminal process until it has been violated. But there are multiple trips perhaps that have to be made. First, the petitioner has to go and fill out the petition. If they've done it on the same day before a certain time, then they can go that day and have the temporary order. Sometimes they have to come back the next day. Once that order has been served and the respondent, the person against whom the order is being issued, if that person wants a contested hearing, then they have to come back again and maybe two times. And then certainly if there are violations of that order, then it becomes a criminal process, and then we would have to meet with them. So to answer in short, it could be multiple, a handful, upwards of a dozen times from the time that they petition a restraining order until there are violations. And just to get to your point of postings, I would say in my personal experience, I have heard from so many victims who've said that they were able to access services, whether it's advocacy, whether it's our office, because they saw a posting either on the bathroom and were able to take that phone number with them. As to Representative Thatcher's suggestion, it's an excellent suggestion for a person to have with them information, but sometimes that becomes a safety concern if the perpetrator finds that information in the home. So I completely agree there needs to be a way to provide this information, whether it's by postings or for that person to choose to take information with them.
May I follow up?
Okay, thank you. Quick follow-up. We have two more people to speak. Quickly.
Actually, maybe if we could get together offline to go over this, because I think what Representative Thatcher is after, where you just have an employment book, so it'd be part of everybody's hiring process, so they knew their rights up front, and then you have it with you all the time, so everybody would have it in the household. But are there protections from them employment-wise, like if I filed a restraining order against somebody, they contested it, can my employer fire me if I said, hey, I have to go to court because my restraining order is being contested?
Very quickly.
The short answer, Representative, is yes, you can be fired. People have been fired.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. J.L. Wilson and Elizabeth Kushwa. And while they're coming up, we also received written testimony and support from Rachel Berry Dame.
Thank you, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries. It was important to me personally and as an organization that you hear from the business community in support of 2903. The posting requirement's not that big of a deal. The real meat of the bill is the what's the eligible employee, and you're basically eliminating the 25 hours per week for 180 days prior to accessing the accommodation or anti-discrimination rights. And I just want to, again, convey to the committee that the business community believes this is a good change. I believe there was probably some crude tie-in with the barriers to entry for OFLA. It really doesn't apply here. It's nothing more than a crude match, and it really doesn't need to be in place. So the bill is, we support it.
Thank you very much. Ms. Kushwa?
Hello. For the record, Elizabeth Kushwa with Foley. The Bureau is in full support of House Bill 2903. We understand the importance of economic security to breaking the cycle of domestic violence for victims. Also, we are aware of the increasing intrusion of domestic violence into the workplace in Oregon, and this is one other way to create protections and awareness in a workplace. There is no cost to the employers, as these forms are provided. No cost from Foley, downloadable from our website. In addition, we've worked with domestic violence, advocates of domestic violence protections to create the brochures. And in addition, we also have our technical assistance to employers department that gives training for employers throughout the state all year round. And so I feel that this bill is a strong and important step forward for the state. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kettimer, then Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
earlier, caucus staff provided me with some information about the postings. I'm a little hung up there, and I appreciate the willingness to work with that. Small employers have, at least according to the research that we've done, 6 requirements. Larger employees have 2 additional. Agriculture has 4, and I'm pretty sure this is not all of them. And I just wonder if Boley could maybe do something about figuring out how to consolidate and do a better job of presenting those. Mm-hmm. I hearken back to, frankly, my experience in college when I got a job driving a truck. And I wish to this day, because of my permanent back injury, that I'd read a little bit about workers' comp. I'm just thinking, you know, maybe even a letter from the chair encouraging it or something. There must be a better way to create it so that it's in a format that people will really have access to it. Posting it on a billboard on the back of a timetable is what this one was. It's not an effective way to communicate it tonight. But I think it needs to be there, and we need to figure out how to do it. Surely we can do it better.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Daugherty, quickly, Representative Kenemer. We do have some consolidated posters as well that have more than one thing at a time, so try to get away from the wallpapering.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Weiner?
Actually, Representative Kenemer, Thatcher is kind of on it, and where I was going before is if we could have a booklet that we just give to an employer that they sit out and employees can just grab them and they look up, oh, domestic violence, page 52, I turn to that page, these are my rights. So because it's getting to be where there's so many, there should just be something that comes with a hiring packet to where either sheet by sheet or a booklet with an index so they can go look for what they want would be ideal if Boley could provide that. I think would be the best way to address this.
Chair Daugherty, Representative Weiner, I'll take that back to the powers of the
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay, if not, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2903. And I also have no other business. I adjourn the meeting of the House Business and Labor Committee. Thank you very much.